Hello there. Today is Thursday, January 30th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president's impeachment trial turns into a major debate over a form top Trump aides possibly will testimony.
I think we're in for a very interesting end of this week and the beginning of next week.
The World Health Organization is reviewing the international severity of the coronavirus. Also ahead, singer Billie Eilish, fresh off big wins at the Grammy Awards, now has a whole nother big event to look to. It's all on today's International Edition. Wednesday marked the next phase of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump, which is the question and answer period. Senators have a total of 16 hours over 2 days to probe impeachment managers in the House, as well as the White House defense team. Senators are not allowed to talk during those questions, so they're submitting them in writing to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Justice John Roberts, who reads them out loud while stating who is asking, as lawmakers continue to argue for and against having witnesses to testify. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson files this report from the Capitol.
Outside the U.S. Capitol, protesters calling for more information. Part of the majority of the American public who say they want to see new evidence and testimony in the Senate impeachment trial, starting with former National Security Advisor John Bolton. A call supported by some Republican senators. Senator Mitt Romney, Republican.
John Bolton, for instance, may be able to tell us precisely when the decision was made not to provide the aid on an immediate basis to Ukraine and what the president's reasoning was at that point. I mean, these are questions that we've seen no evidence on at this stage, and I'd like to get that answer.
But it's still unclear if there will be enough Republican support for calling witnesses when that vote likely occurs this Friday. Republican Senator Susan Collins.
I have no idea how the votes are going to fall.
A decision Democrats say decides the ultimate fairness of the trial. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine.
Before there's a vote on conviction or acquittal, there's going to be a vote on whether this is a trial or a sham.
The question phase of the impeachment trial turned into a debate over allowing witnesses. Chief Justice John Roberts reading a senator's question.
Is there any way for the Senate to render a fully informed verdict in this case without hearing the testimony of Bolton, Mulvaney, and the other key eyewitnesses, or without seeing the relevant documentary evidence?
Democratic Congressman and House impeachment manager Adam Schiff.
The short answer to that question is no. There's no way to have a fair trial without witnesses.
But each side also got an opportunity to refine their argument against the impeachment of Trump and in support of it. Alan Dershowitz, Trump defense attorney.
The president does something which he believes will help him get elected in the public interest. That cannot be the kind of quid pro quo that results in impeachment.
House impeachment manager, Congressman Adam Schiff.
If you look at the pattern in this president's conduct and his words, what you see is a president who identifies the state as being himself.
Senators will have 8 more hours for questions Thursday, followed by the all-important decision on witnesses by the end of the week. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
Well, joining us now to talk further about this is Dr. Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. What's your take on what we've missed, or what we've witnessed, I should say, so far?
Well, everything changed as a result of the Times story involving some materials in the Bolton memoirs. According to the story, the Bolton memoirs say that the president directly told Mr. Bolton that the support for Ukraine was being held up until the Ukraine did something to investigate the Biden. And that has really roiled things in the Senate because it puts the Republicans in a very difficult position. You know, they wanted to get this thing over quickly. And if there were no Bolton, then, you know, right now they'd be talking about having a vote and, you know, the matter would be probably dismissed. But the fact is that it's very hard to pretend that the Bolton materials don't exist, and it's very hard to argue that they're not credible because Bolton is known as being very conservative, as a hawk, and certainly no indication that he is on the other, quote, side, close quote, from President Trump. And so the bind the Republicans are in is they can blow it off and say, yeah, we don't want to hear it. And then when the memoirs are published, having people say, wait a minute, you could have heard all this and it wouldn't have made any difference in your judgment. Or they can say, okay, let's have Bolton testify and then thereby delay the proceedings and possibly leading to a change in mind by many of the Republicans that, by golly, a quid pro quo was discovered. So the Republicans are in a real bind on this, in my view.
Well, the White House now also, it's blocking the manuscript of the Bolton book from coming out. Can they do that?
They're simply looking for, are there any classified materials? Everybody who's worked with classified materials has that obligation. I have that obligation. But can they keep it from the Senate? Realistically, no. And the reason is, if the Republicans are demanding to see it, how can the Republican president say ixnay? And does that really help the president if he does say no?
So ultimately, where do you think we're headed here with all of this?
Well, this is a really thorny problem. My instinct, and this is nothing more than an instinct, is that ultimately Bolton will testify. Now, they may end up with a paired deal. That is, Bolton testifies and then Hunter Biden testifies. But I don't think that's, it'd be embarrassing for the Bidens, but ultimately I don't think it'd have much of an effect on the outcome. It's not as if anything Hunter or Joe Biden did excuses the president's conduct. So I think we're in for a very interesting end of this week and the beginning of next week.
All right. Well, Robert Deitz, he is a professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. We appreciate your perspective. Well, the Senate is expected to vote on whether to call witnesses to testify in the impeachment trial this Friday. And if they vote yes, it would mean that next week Trump will deliver his State of the Union speech while being tried for his removal from office. Two American presidents have done this in the past, Bill Clinton and Richard Nixon. Patsy Wittakuswara, VOA White House correspondent, looks at how past presidents navigated the situation and what Trump can learn from them.
The President of the United States!
Trump may become the third president in American history to deliver his State of the Union speech under the threat of removal from office, following Bill Clinton in 1999.
Let us lift our eyes as one nation, and from the mountaintop of this American century, look ahead to the next one, asking God's blessing on our endeavors and on our beloved country.
And Richard Nixon in 1974. Facing impeachment from the Watergate scandal, Nixon used part of his speech to defend himself.
I believe the time has come to bring that investigation and the other investigations of this matter to an end. 1 year of Watergate is enough.
Well, Clinton took a different approach.
It was a very optimistic, upbeat speech about how good conditions in the United States were, how powerful the American economy was, and how many jobs had been created and what economic recovery had been done, but completely ignored the impeachment issue.
The February 5th speech is particularly important to Trump ahead of the November election.
The economy is roaring along. Unemployment has been extremely low. In fact, the unemployment rate for African Americans and Hispanics has hit record lows. I mean, those are the kind of achievements that I think a president would want to talk about no matter what else is going on in Congress, including impeachment.
Clinton was acquitted while Nixon resigned before he was impeached. Analysts expect Trump's approach to be a mix of his predecessors.
He will probably extol the achievements of his administration, particularly on the economy, but he will also probably mention impeachment and probably attack quite strongly the Democrats for their policy on that.
If his rallies are any indication, whatever happens in his impeachment trial, Trump will likely continue to project optimism.
This November, we are going to win back the House, we are going to hold the Senate, and we are going to keep
the White House.
Patsy Yudakiswara, VOA News.
World health officials are expressing great concern that a dangerous new virus is starting to spread between people outside of China. Troubling development as China and the world works to contain the coronavirus outbreak. For a second day, the number of infections grew dramatically to almost 6,000. Scientists say there are many questions to be answered about the new virus, including just how easily it spreads and how severe it is. Joining us to talk more about this is Art Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center and founding director of the Division of Medical Ethics. Thanks for being with us. So can you first explain just exactly what this virus is?
A coronavirus is in the family of cold viruses. So there are four strains that are circulating around. That's what gives us a cold. We know that colds get into our lungs and they get into our bronchi. When one of these virus mutates, changes its genetic information, which they do periodically, just randomly, you can get SARS, or in this case, whatever we're going to call this, the coronavirus from China, that is much more nasty. The reason it's nasty, it goes way into the lungs and causes pneumonia. The colds kind of stay in the upper part of the lungs, or in what we call the bronchi, the little tubes that lead down from our mouths to our lungs. They're uncomfortable, but they're not lethal. How did it happen? Best bet, somehow there was contagion from animals carrying these mutated viruses into people. I'm suspicious that it took place in one of these markets where they have live animals that they kill and there's blood around and that sort of thing.
How is it that it's spreading so fast? Is it just highly, highly contagious?
Yeah, think of the cold. Virus, you know, you sneeze, you put droplets in the air, you touch a doorknob, you basically have a virus that likes to transmit in wet environments or by globules in the air. That seems to be what the root is for this virus. There does seem to be human-to-human transmission, and I'm going to say it's acting like a cold virus or our old friend the flu.
Would you say it's reached epidemic proportions?
I'd say it has. Absolutely in China, they've got, you know, thousands of people infected. They've got hundreds of people dying. So for them, definitely an epidemic. Is it a worldwide epidemic? Not quite yet. Not that many cases. There's some, obviously, in many countries around the world. But I think the signal is there that within a matter of days, the WHO will declare it an epidemic.
Why do you say that?
Because it's spreading pretty quickly within China, and the number of countries outside of China that are showing cases, multiple cases, Australia, the U.S., and so on. That's a signal that you probably got an epidemic. So the categories sound a little scary, but an epidemic just basically means a lot of transmission around the world, highly infective, and something that can cause death, although we don't really know, is it in old people, is it in babies, is it just in anyone? But the signal is rapid transmission, human to human, looks pretty infectious, and something that's nasty.
You know, when you hear the news reports about this thing and it's continuing to spread and they're evacuating people out of this place in China, is this all just precautionary, or it sounds scary? Is it as scary as it sounds, or is it just precautionary so that it doesn't become something very bad?
I think it's precautionary. Not as scary as it sounds. It's not like people are just peeling over in the streets and they got to get these people out of there, you know, because it's the equivalent of, you know, an impending bursting dam or some kind of earthquake that's coming. Very precautionary, trying to move people away from the source of infection, which so far really is confined to central China. That's why the Chinese are quarantining those cities and not allowing travel out. All precautionary. Obviously, the people inside those cities are at much higher risk. That's dangerous. But travel restrictions or evacuations, these are precautionary.
So you're expecting the World Health Organization will declare it an epidemic. Is that Is that the same as a global health emergency?
Yes, and I think we'll get both descriptions. It's just spread fast enough, and it looks like it's got human-to-human transmission like colds do and so on. I think it's big enough now that they're going to have to declare it as such.
Can people get this just airborne, or do they have to be in physical contact with it?
Ebola was a disease that we all freaked out about, but you had to be in physical contact, and so its transmission was tough, and we didn't really, I think we overreacted to that one. This one is looking like it's airborne. Droplets in the air, somebody sneezes in a room, you could pick it up. It doesn't appear to be as contagious, by the way, as measles, which is like the super contagious thing. You can get that being in a room where someone with the measles was there like 2 days ago. I don't think it's that communicable, but it does look like it's one of these sneezing, coughing, into the atmosphere kind of things.
All right, that is Art Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center, and he's also the founding director of the Division of Medical Ethics. Thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. The U.S. is warning information sharing is at risk as Britain approves a Huawei 5G rollout. Democratic presidential contenders are making their final push in Iowa, the first test of the presidential campaign. U.S. issues fresh sanctions now over Ukraine's Crimea, the Treasury, according to the Treasury website, and several Minnesota men who joined al-Shabaab say they are now remorseful. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump has signed into law the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, or USMCA, replacing the North America Free Trade Agreement. VOA's Steve Herman reports.
Although support from opposition Democrats was vital for passage of the USMCA trade pact, they were not at the ceremony. Trump administration officials say a few were invited but declined to attend amid the fierce partisan divide in Washington, where Trump is on trial in the Senate after being impeached in the House, something the president alluded to in his remarks at Wednesday's ceremony.
We do have some incredible people that work so hard, and senators. And maybe I'm being just nice to them because I want their vote. Does that make sense? I don't want to leave anybody out.
Much of the USMCA is an update to the quarter-century-old NAFTA, with new laws related to intellectual property protection, the internet, currencies, investment, and state-owned enterprises. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
According to the nonprofit group World's Children, an estimated 21 million people are victims of human trafficking. Many of them are undocumented Hispanic women who are hard to track because they're often afraid to seek help from authorities. VOA's Christina Sacedo Smith reports.
Undocumented Hispanic women in the United States can often be victims of human trafficking. Experts say because they live in the shadows to avoid being deported, they are easier prey for criminals.
Some of the cases we see are women who work as maids. The employer takes away their passport or hides it. They don't let them communicate with their family, and most of the victims we see are Hispanics.
Heidi Alvarez is the director of social services at SAFE, a University of Maryland initiative which supports victims of labor exploitation and human trafficking.
Sometimes people, if they are undocumented, are afraid to reach out to police. They are afraid to seek help.
According to a report by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, human trafficking generated $150 billion annually for criminal organizations during 2018. The National Helpline received more than 41,000 telephone calls.
When it comes to men, you'll see a lot of victims in the construction business or agriculture industries, while women we encounter mostly in I would consider domestic jobs and or illicit massage parlors or businesses.
Joe Geronimo, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security Investigations, underscores the point that immigrants without documents are more vulnerable.
That is an area that human trafficking organizations will exploit because of their vulnerability of being exposed to law enforcement because of their immigration status. Again, that is something they see as a weakness and again, we'll prey upon.
In Montgomery County, Maryland, which has a high Hispanic population, local lawmakers say it is extremely important to talk about the issue.
To, you know, meet people who have been and beaten and drugged and forced to have sex or forced to perform labor against their will for months at a time or years at a time and a part of that life, they need a lot of support from us, and the public needs to become aware of the signs of it so they can bring it to the attention of our law enforcement and our county government.
Authorities Authorities also warn about the need to be careful with social media. They say many criminal gangs use online tools to promote non-existing jobs as a way to lure potential victims. Cristina Quecedo-Smith, VOA News, Washington.
And you are listening to International Edition. We will be back in a minute.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about, sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower, and change the rules. It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka. Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA News Feeds. VOAnews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, at the Computer History Museum at the heart of Silicon Valley, African entrepreneurs, investors, and others gathered recently to talk about the future of business on the continent. Among the topics discussed, the economic power of remittances and how to turn them into investment avenues for startups, protecting intellectual property of African firms, and how to bring more companies and investors to the continent. Michelle Quinn talked to entrepreneurs and investors.
At the Computer History Museum in the heart of Silicon Valley, people gathered recently at the African Diaspora Investment Symposium to talk about the future of Africa business.
In the past, many Africans, and especially people like me from the diaspora, were not invited to the table to really discuss on issues that matter to the continent. So we said, well, what if we can just bring everyone together so we can have that discussion at the same table?
Remittances, money sent by people living in the U.S. to family in Africa, has long been a key way to support the continent, speakers said. But Nagash and others said there are other uses of diaspora funds.
How do we scale remittances so that it can also be invested in other people than our family? Supporting startups.
While many investors and businesses want to come to Africa, it can be a challenge to navigate, which is why African nations have been working on the African Continental Free Trade Area, said Joseph Matura, Google's first sub-Saharan African lead and now a minister in the Kenyan government.
How do they, with the different regulations, different countries, be able to get into the continent? So we are providing the platform that they can now use. They come, and as part of the Continental Free Trade Area, they are able to then go to many of the other different markets.
For the roughly 50 African entrepreneurs attending the event, this was an opportunity to pitch their businesses. Abubakar Kamara, an architect from Guinea, is working on a housing startup.
We're implicating people in the process of actually building their homes. You know, we want to change the concept of what is architecture? Because architecture has a lot to do with your identity.
Nenik Holis is the chief executive of a sports technology company in South Africa.
We have a smart wearable that is sewn to the garments around the joint ankles of the athlete's garments.
Barbara Burungi Mutabazi runs Uganda Women in Technology, which trains female students and young women for technology jobs like coding.
Yeah, I've made some really good connections, especially in terms of funding, fundraising.
And I'm proud to be a second-generation family business leader.
For many of the attendees, the event was a welcome chance to talk about Africa's successes. Thelma Akayor runs a Nigeria-based business accelerator and an investment fund for women-run businesses.
I think one of the problems that Africa's had for years is we tend not to talk about the progress and the developments that are happening on the continent, so it's been a pleasure to come here and share with people that live here in the valley about the work that we're doing.
The connections made at this event can be long-lasting, as people look for ways to be part of the burgeoning African business sector. Michelle Quinn, VOA News, Mountain View, California.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA has announced that the Spitzer Space Telescope mission will end on January 30, 2020. Launched in 2003, Spitzer has studied the solar system to the far edges of the known universe in infrared light. By observing the cosmos at infrared wavelengths, scientists could see things too cold to produce much visible light, such as exoplanets, brown dwarfs, and cold matter in interstellar space. Among its many accomplishments, Spitzer studied and identified some of the oldest galaxies in the universe. It also analyzed the chemical composition of interstellar dust, providing scientists with new insight into the elements that form planets and stars. In addition, Spitzer investigated and provided information on the chemical makeup of distant planets' atmospheres. While it was designed for only a 2 to 5 year mission, Spitzer provided valuable data for more than 16 years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Eighteen-year-old breakthrough pop singer Billie Eilish, who just swept all top four categories at last weekend's Grammy Awards, including Best Song and Album of the Year, Best New Artist, Best Pop Vocal Album, will now be performing at Hollywood's biggest awards ceremony as well. Eilish's appearance is being billed as a special performance by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences at the Oscar ceremony next Sunday evening. Eilish will be performing the title song to the new upcoming James Bond film, No Time to Die, which a song she wrote with her older brother, Phineas. Eilish is the youngest artist in history to write and record a James Bond movie theme song.
Nobody even noticed, I saw them standing right there. Kinda thought they might care. I had a dream.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you for listening, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Tried to scream, but my head was underwater. They called me weak, like I'm not just somebody's daughter. It could have been a nightmare, but it felt like they were right there. And it feels like yesterday was a year ago.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil.